by talking about axioms for abstract pure state quantum theory. So I know you've done axioms and so on with Joe Emerson, but I want to write down some basic axioms so I can set up the discussion which comes next. So after that, I'll do the measurement problem, also known as the reality problem. And then I'll look at a few interesting examples of quantum theory, the no-cloning theorem and the quantum Zeno effect. So let's give some axioms. This is for abstract case. Pure states. So the first axiom says that for each type of system, you have a Hilbert space associated with it. And in this notation, let's see. So the Hilbert space is of a certain dimension. And in this notation, A denotes the system type, so A, B, C, etc. So, for example, if it's an electron or a photon of a certain polarization degree, the degree of freedom of a photon, something like this. And the integer denotes the particular instance of that type of system. Are we going to stick with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces? Here, for simplicity. Yep.
If we're talking about a particular instance of a system,
yeah,
wouldn't we be referring to a vector in the Hilbert space rather than the Hilbert space itself?
So what I'm saying here is each system instance has a Hilbert space associated with it. And then the next part, well, the vector in the Hilbert space will come in a few axioms.
Okay.
Yeah. So ask me after axiom three if it's not clear. So for axiom two, it concerns composite systems. And a composite system we can denote by giving a list of the type labels along with the instance labels, like this. So for a composite system, the Hilbert space that's associated with that is just given by the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for each of the components. So in this example, it would be like this. And now the state of the system and remember here we're dealing only with the pure case. This could be a composite system. Is at So this answers the question. I couldn't mention the state before I'd mentioned composite systems because the state may be entangled, for example, in which case you can't associate a state to each of the components, but only to the total system. So now we come to fourth axiom, which concerns evolution. We have two parts. The first part is unproblematic. Well, actually, both parts are problematic. So if there's no measurement made, then the state evolves unitarily. When you do a measurement, then the state is projected down to the term that's associated with the outcome of that measurement. So this is the projector associated with the outcome. And this is especially problematic. We'll discuss that in a moment. Yeah, so the problem associated with this is the reality problem. This term was coined by a guy called Philip Pearl. He's responsible for the sort of collapse approach to quantum theory. And usually it's called the measurement problem. But this is a better name for it. So let's consider the example we discussed yesterday. So we have a source. A particle hits a beam splitter and it goes this way or that way. So the state evolves like this. We have the initial state of the particle and the two detectors. In the ready states. Then that evolves to this. I'm going to assume these detectors absorb the particle. So either this detector fires or this detector fires. And now if we apply axiom 4, we make a measurement. Then we project the state down to the term associated with the outcome that we see. So imagine, for example, we see outcome B. Then the state goes to that. And then we need an extra axiom. We say that the probability associated with this is given by the square modulus of the amplitude in front of that term. Let me write that over here. Okay. But there's kind of a problem here that this second form of evolution is somehow strange. You're just collapsing. When something that you choose to call the measurement happens, we could imagine not collapsing, And in fact, we could include the person looking at the apparatus, imagine it's me, in the experiment. And then it would evolve like this. If we just keep everything unitary. So this is me before I see an outcome over here. And then this is me seeing the outcome B corresponding to this term, and me seeing the outcome C corresponding to that term. Now, we kind of have two choices. We can either accept that we should have this part B to axiom 4, in which case we collapse, and that presents a bunch of problems. Or we could say, well, we shouldn't have part B. We should only apply unitary evolution, and that presents a bunch of problems. So in the case where we only apply unitary evolution, the state we end up with is this. And there's a problem because this state doesn't seem to have a definite outcome. This has both terms. So there's a discrepancy between the way we experience the world and the most obvious interpretation of the quantum state. So if we do not project, then we have a discrepancy between the interpretation that this state represents the true situation, that represents reality, and our experience of the world. Any questions on that?
Yep. That's many worlds, yeah.
Definitely trying to make sense of this would lead to many worlds, yeah. Well, there's also the de Broglie we'll cover, is also consistent with this point of view. Yeah. You had a question?
Yeah, I have a question about the last time where you do the projection.
Yeah.
You still want to write the amplitude in front of that.
Well, what you can then do is people then usually normalize the state so that it has it goes back to having normalization 1. That's the usual practice. It's really a matter of how you decide to calculate your conditional probabilities. So if you're just calculating joint probabilities, then you wouldn't want to normalize. But if you want to now input this as your new state into some experiment and condition everything on having successfully prepared this state, then you would want to prepare it. So that's, it's more of a calculational matter.
Related to what he asked, one often identifies states with rays in the Hilbert space.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the normalization you're talking about, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that's right. So the usual point of view is that quantum states are just normalized. So given that they're just normalized, you might as well just associate it with the ray because that information is redundant. My own point of view is that's slightly wrong. That's not the right way to think about it. That you should really think of as that information in front of the state as being important, and it provides somehow your joint probability for everything having happened up to this stage. And if you throw it away, you're losing something important. It's really just a matter of when you decide to conditionalize. If you have a long experiment with lots of measurements along the way, if you just keep the state as it is, and you have an outcome here, and an outcome here, and an outcome here, then you can take the square of that amplitude at the end to get the joint probability of all these outcomes happening. On the other hand, if you normalize after each step, then you have to involve yourself with conditional probabilities, which are nonlinear because you have things in the denominator. And so it just gets a bit more messy. But most people would prefer to take the conditionalizing approach. This is really a mathematical issue, but it's, yes?
So you can make any state, any mixed state, pure by interrogating a larger Hilbert space.
That's right, yeah.
Is it true that we can make any non-unitary operator or non-unitary evolution unitary by interrogating a larger Hilbert space?
Yeah, there's the Steinspring extension. So suddenly, any completely positive trace-preserving map can always be regarded as a unit operator on a bigger Hilbert space. And there's a theorem to that end. If the map is not trace-preserving, if it's trace-decreasing, then you have a bit of a problem. But if you consider the complete set of maps that are associated with a situation, then you can still do it. So what is true is that you can always take this pure state point of view if you want to, even in the case where you would normally use mixed states and completely positive maps and so on. There's an interesting debate in the literature. There's sort of two points of view. They're called the church of the smaller Hilbert space and the church of the larger Hilbert space. So the church of the larger Hilbert space is that you should do this, take pure states, and always find a system big enough that you can regard the thing as pure and the evolution as unitary. And then there's the church of the smaller Hilbert space, which says that you should think of just the system you have, and that then you use density matrices and completely positive maps, and that those objects are fundamental. They're interesting points of view because they motivate different approaches to quantum theory. And so although I'm giving you here the standard axioms for the church of the larger Hilbert space, I would actually regard myself as a member of the smaller Hilbert space church. Maybe I'll get to that at the end of the course. I think there's even Facebook pages for these different searches, so you can join either or both churches. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Any more questions here? This is
What does it mean that A1 and A2 denote the same type of system? Does it mean only that age of A1 is the same as age of A2? Or do we want some indistinguishability?
So here I'm shying away from the issue of indistinguishability because I don't think it doesn't really shed conceptual light on these kinds of questions. Now, even in the case that you have, say, A1 and A2 are both, say, electrons, as long as you keep them separate and they each have their own, they're operationally distinguished, this one is over here, this one is over here, then you don't have to worry about any of the symmetrization issues that come with indistinguishability. So I'm not going to get into that subject. So I think at this level I'm thinking of the fact that they have separate numbers, 1 and 2, associated with them means that they're operationally distinguishable. You know this one is here and that one is there.
So do you mean that A1 and A2 are both electrons and B1 and B3 is something else?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So A1 and A2 are both electrons and B3 is a photon or something. And certainly, so long as you keep the two particles separate, this is fine. You don't have to worry about the symmetrization. The moment they overlap, then you would have to worry about if they overlap in space. Now you could go to a Fock space point of view. So now rather than thinking of the electron as the type of system, you're thinking of the excitations of the field as the type of system, and that would actually put you kind of back in the operational picture because your modes are the modes of your space are associated with operationally accessible parts of your system. But I don't want to get into the issue of distinguishability and indistinguishability because it's a whole new can of worms that I'm not going to open. So these kind of axioms, they work very well for quantum optical experiments of one sort or another where you have this operational distinguishability. Any more questions? So yeah, so we just discussed what happens if you ignore axiom B and you never project. Then you have this discrepancy. Note that I talk about the sort of where you just imagine that this is a description of this represents reality. Then you kind of have two terms. You have this kind of discrepancy. The other choice is to say, well, no, we actually do have this projection. That it's a real physical process. And the problem then is the boards align. Just trying. The problem then is that there's the theory becomes kind of ill-defined. So we say that projection is a real physical process, we call it collapse, then there's a problem with the theory being ill-defined. But the problem is, what types of physical systems can constitute measurement apparatuses and what don't? Why should we say that one particular type of box, if it's big enough, constitutes a measurement apparatus and another doesn't? What's the level at which we say a measurement has actually happened? Does it have to be, is it sufficient for the object to be macroscopic? Or does it have to actually be a person who looks at the system? And so we find that the theory is getting into murky waters. If physical theories don't usually refer to whether a physical object is conscious or not, for example. That would seem like a very odd thing. Which physical systems count as measurement apparatuses? And now it turns out that in practice, for all practical purposes, this is an expression coined by John Bell. It doesn't matter. So long as your system is sufficiently macroscopic, it doesn't matter where you decide the collapse happens. You could say it happens when the detector clicks, or you could say it happens when the appropriate neurons in the brain of the experimentalist fire, so long as the system is sufficiently macroscopic. And the reason it doesn't matter is because by the time the system is sufficiently macroscopic, then it will have interacted so much with everything else that it will be effectively impossible to reverse that interaction and recover the sort of quantum effects that are associated with superposition, i.e. interference.
So that's linked with quantum erasure.
Right, so the quantum eraser is a very interesting example, because in that case, in order to actually practically be able to erase that information, you have to keep the detection at a quantum level. So you got the homework, so that has that question in your, in that case, really it's whether these atoms have decayed or not and substitute and deposited a photon, but it's still at a quantum level. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But there's no number. You know, there's no number. You can't say, well, you know, above 10 to the 23 atoms it happens, because these axioms don't have that number. It would be very strange to put that number in. On the other hand, actually, there is an approach pioneered by Philip Pohl and others where you actually do modify the Schrodinger equation and introduce collapse explicitly. And we'll talk about that in a few lectures' time. So this is the problem. It's sort of you have, you know, two horns of the dilemma. Either you don't collapse, but then you get this reality problem that the state doesn't seem to represent our experience. Or if you do collapse, then you have that the theory is ill-defined. And although it doesn't matter, although for all practical purposes it doesn't matter, in principle it does matter. In principle, if you were sufficiently clever, you could design an experiment to distinguish when the collapse happened. So it does actually, in principle, have an empirical consequence. So John Bell introduced this expression FAP as a sort of rhetorical device. You know, he's trying to show that this FAP reasoning seems to be playing a role in fundamental physics, and he thought that was a bad thing. Okay. There are two components to the measurement problem it's worth highlighting. Or to the reality problem. We call it the reality problem. First component is when you do this collapse, you seem to pick out a particular basis. So over here, for example, we picked out the basis in which one of the detectors fires or not, and I see a particular outcome. And so the question is, what is the basis? With respect to which so what is the basis with respect to which we see definite outcomes? Because you could instead, the basis could be things like check, here's two states, they're orthogonal. So one corresponds to the case where I have the perception where I see C plus I see D, and the other is where I have the perception I see C minus I see D. Why don't I have experiences like that? And this question is regarded as being answered by decoherence. So decoherence tells us that typically the states which make sense for being the correct basis are the ones which are macroscopically distinguishable, so with respect to position. And the reason for that is that typical Hamiltonians that occur in nature are local with regard to position. So there is a sort of answer to that question. So that's one component to the measurement problem, or the reality problem. The other component is more serious. And the question is, what picks out a particular outcome? What gives rise to the observation a particular outcome is seen. And certainly, if you don't have explicit collapse, then you don't have, neither term is picked out. So why is one term picked out every time? So we'll talk about ways of resolving the measurement problem, the various interpretations that are out there next week. So I'm going to move on to a different topic. Any questions left on the measurement problem before I move on? Yeah.
I'm not sure I understood your argument for why one is answered by decoherence.
Okay.
It's that, like, what you've written down there strikes me as very strange in a way that maybe I'm having a little trouble wrapping my head around, but it seems, for the particle to be at C and for the particle to be at B, we're very used to, by this point, it can be in a superposition of C and D, but it seems different when you're writing, states for different experiences that you're having, because even to write down, I see C as a state, is kind of already assuming that observers have definite experiences. Like, I don't even know what it would mean for, like, you can do a test to see, like, is this particle in C plus D or C minus D, but what would, it's almost incoherent to say, like, I see C plus or minus I see D.
But is it incoherent to say I see C or?
I don't know. I'm having a little trouble articulating what I'm thinking, I guess.
I mean, one way to think about this is to go one step back, not to involve consciousness in the picture, just to try to say what I want my physical theory to do is to provide a way of accounting for sort of the world of tables and chairs and so on that we see around us. So even if no one's in the room, that we imagine there are tables and chairs and things located in nice positions, and that the physical theory picks out that basis rather than tables and chairs being in crazy superpositions as somehow the right one. One thing that some of the interpretations do is exactly that. In fact, they all try to do that even before observation, even before consciousness is invoked. I was just trying to go one step further. And even here, these two components, they're actually difficult to separate out, because what I'm trying to say is, here the question is there a natural basis somehow suggested by the mathematics to do this? And the natural basis, the argument is that the natural basis is the one in which the density matrix is approximately diagonal. Okay, so that's really more of a mathematical naturalness argument, whereas this is the really hard problem. What is it that picks up one thing or the other? Is that my?
That helps some.
Oh. Yes. I mean, people talk about this a lot.
When you gave the example of the interferometer where we put detectors on either arm and it stopped the interference, what in the actual lab setup corresponds to, or say, why isn't there decoherence even when the detectors aren't there? Is there, if you're doing this with a laser or something, is there no interaction with the air around you, or is it too slow? Or?
Right. So if you, whenever experimentalists do these kinds of interference experiments, they're trying to eliminate as much as possible any sorts of decoherence effects like that. So photons, you know, over the size of a typical quantum optical experiment, don't entangle too much with the environment. If you're doing atom experiments, then you need to get very good vacuums to make sure that you don't get decoherence.
Is it right to think of it as like too slow? Like, is there sort of a bubble of decoherence expanding outwards, and the light gets to the detectors before that hits you, or is that a weird picture?
You're certainly right that the bigger you try to make the interferometer, the more you have to fight against decoherence. Then that will just depend on the details of the experiment you have. It's interesting, even with atom experiments, for example, if you do atom experiments over, you know, a sufficiently small scale, and the radiation, the ambient radiation you have around has a wavelength longer than that scale, then decoherence doesn't affect the experiment so much. There are all sorts of processes that you might think would lead to decoherence that don't necessarily. So another example is if you have molecules, if you try to interfere molecules, so this has been done by Zeilinger in Vienna. You take a big molecule and you send it through one path or another. Well, the molecule itself has lots of internal degrees of freedom that you think would lead to decoherence. But they don't, because they're doing the same thing essentially in the two paths. They don't distinguish which path you're in. In the end, the fact that you see interference is a proof that your people are able to set up these situations with low decoherence. You had a question.
So you said no matter what we choose, if we choose the collapse to happen or not to happen, it leads to problems.
Mm-hmm.
The solution for using decoherence, does that assume collapse or no collapse?
So I would say decoherence is not a solution to the measurement problem, but it's a sort of partial solution. It's a solution to the question as to what's the natural basis to do to have your definite outcomes with respect to. But it doesn't provide an answer to the collapse issue. So in fact, if you look at the many worlds interpretation, that literature, they use decoherence arguments a lot. And in the many worlds interpretation, there's no collapse. So decoherence is really answering a particular mathematical question as to which is the most natural basis. It's sort of separate, really, from the collapse issue. Am I answering your?
Yes. You mentioned also the small Hilbert space church and the large Hilbert space.
Right.
Don't you need, for the coherence to happen, don't you need an open quantum system? So
yeah,
that
yeah.
Be part of the small Hilbert space?
So in the large Hilbert space, the open, you know, that you have some system that you're tracing over that you're.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a problem, because that's it's very unnatural to say, you know, I will ignore certain degrees of freedom. You know, that's a very arbitrary thing to do. In the small Hilbert space approach, your framework just ignores those,
mm-hmm.
because of the way it's set up. But it doesn't really help resolve the measurement problem any better.
Could you actually clarify the argument for just the why that follows, the one claim you're making, that these somehow will be less favored states of the superposition of these sorts of things? What exactly?
Let's see. See if I can give a quick, ready explanation. So if you have coming into your, let's imagine you have some environment, so you have some system, S, which is in a a reasonably good position state, so a fairly localized state. I'm going to call it. Then you have some environment. And then you act on that with a Hamiltonian. And that Hamiltonian is local with regard to, you have some x in here, so states are fairly local with regard to your x coordinate. And this Hamiltonian is local also with regard to that, so it doesn't have terms that interact different points in space. Then the argument is that this will, over short times at least, just stay the same, or at least it will only evolve. This will not get entangled with this. So that's the argument. So to really see that, I'd have to write down an explicit Hamiltonian and do the calculation, and I don't have an example to hand.
But just in principle, and for these sort of like large macroscopic things like ICC or ICD, is it that?
Yeah, so then you can see that if I had two things like this, now you're pushing my my ability to come up with an example just like that.
We could talk about it after too.
Yeah, I think I need to give you a good example, I don't have one to hand. Let's convert later. Okay. Any more questions? So we're almost out of time, and I wanted to go through both the no cloning theorem and the quantum Zeno effect. Choose the no cloning. So your quantum theory is full of these interesting effects, and it's good to look at them and try to get a handle on what's going on. So you didn't do the no cloning theorem in Joe's course, did you?
Maybe you mentioned it. Maybe.
It's not familiar to you, at least from the courses, right? So the theorem itself isn't very old. I think it goes back to the mid or late 80s, and it was a response to one of these papers claiming to signal faster than light, and it turned out they were assuming that you could clone quantum states. So in a sense, those people who made that claim did science a great service, because to show why you couldn't signal faster than light in that case, people had to come up with the no cloning theorem. Imagine we have some machine that clones quantum states. So there's the idea. We have a machine, M. We have an input, a quantum state on a system of type A, inputted into that machine. We apply some unitary evolution, and out come two copies. of the same state. So we want to give a proof that that's not possible. This is what we mean by no cloning. And this is supposed to work for any state. So if it works for any state, then it must also work for this state. Any questions? What's going on at this stage? Clear. Good. And so now, does anyone know how to prove this doesn't work? Curiosity. Yep.
Try and clone a linear combination of those steps.
So, yeah. So there's two strategies to proving this theorem. Yeah. One is exactly that: try to clone a linear combination, and you'll see that fails because these things get entangled, so they don't separate out. And then the other strategy is to use the fact that under unitary evolution, the inner product is preserved. Okay. So if I take the inner product of the left-hand side of these two equations, it must be equal to the inner product of the right-hand side of these two equations. So let's just do that, because we have unitary evolution. So this is equal to 1. So we're taking our states to be normalized. And so now we have either one possibility, one way to satisfy this is to say that these two states are orthogonal. Or we can divide out through by this inner product, and then we have that. Actually, let's I don't know why I did that. That's the wrong way to do it. So we have that just by rearranging this and taking the modulus. Which means that those two states have to be the same up to an arbitrary overall phase. So this proves that you can only clone states if they are either the same or orthogonal. But you can't clone arbitrary states. It's an interesting theorem because it sort of motivates thinking of quantum states as kind of informational. They have this information you can't read it off. You can't clone them. You can't perform a measurement that will tell you what the information is in here. So if you could clone, then you could clone many, many, many times, and then you could discover all the information in the quantum state. But you can't do that. So there's something very interesting happening in these quantum states. And it's a nice theorem. I think in many ways this theorem motivated the quantum information revolution. So certainly this theorem motivates quantum teleportation. Have you done quantum teleportation with Joe?
In a tutorial.
Okay, yeah. So quantum teleportation is only interesting because of the no cloning theorem. You can't clone states, but you can make the same state reappear somewhere else using teleportation. So this is very interesting, and certainly quantum teleportation really started the quantum information revolution going. That was when people really started thinking about quantum states and entanglement as a resource and so on. So I think it's a very interesting theorem. And why this wasn't discovered back in the 1920s or 30s, I think it's because people didn't have the right attitude back then. It took a long time to think about quantum theory in this way. Okay, I'll stop there.